ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if living offline isn't a choice anymore? I'm Rae Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm finding out just how much of our lives are online and whether we can ever really unplug. From privacy experts to hackers, we explore what it means to disappear in a world that's always watching. Opt Out. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
One of the first questions to ask about super, compulsory superannuation, is what it's for. Until December last year, there wasn't even a purpose set out for it in Commonwealth legislation. It took that long, a third of a century from when compulsory super began in 1992, for our leaders to agree on what it was supposed to do. Today we examine what super is for, ask whether the $4 trillion or so dollars we've got saved in it shortchanges us, and try to work out how to make it work for us. I think we're what super is meant to be for. Welcome to The Economy Stupid with me, Peter Martin, and my guest this week, two people who understand our system with all its foibles and are happy to pass their knowledge on to you. Retirement savings expert at the University of Sydney, Susan Thorpe, and Housing and Economic Security Program Director at the Grattan Institute, Brendan Coates. Welcome, Susan. Welcome back, Brendan.
Hi.
Thanks, Peter.
Brendan, I think we need to go back to the mid-80s, actually, when the Hawke government made super compulsory for building workers, not because of a thought-out plan about retirement savings, but as a quick fix for an industrial relations problem. What happened?
So basically, the government and the ACTU were worried that we were going to see a wage price spiral, that inflation was getting out of control. And if they boosted workers' wages the way that the union wanted, then that would increase that or exacerbate inflation. So instead, they came up with a compromise that was essentially that 3% pay rise, instead of going into workers' pockets, went into superannuation. It created the first industrial super funds in Australia today.
You get the money, but you can't spend it immediately.
That's exactly right.
Gee, that was clever. Ralph Willis was the industrial relations minister at the time. As he describes it, the decision to turn what would have been a rogue wage rise into super at a time when wages were meant to be limited by the accord was something of an act of desperation.
We just couldn't let that sit there because it was an open invitation to everyone else to sort of breach the accord. And so the way of resolving it was to turn it into superannuation. And that became the beginnings of widespread blue-collar superannuation, which came about from the mid-80s on, but generally through award superannuation.
Susan, was there any science behind the idea that without compulsion, we wouldn't save enough?
There is some science behind the idea that without compulsion, people don't save enough. And it's partly related to psychological tendencies, human tendencies to overweight the present relative to the future, but it's also driven by incentive structures within the system. We can think of things like, for example, the provision of the age pension as a safety net, the extra taxation that's applied, you might argue, to savings, some social recognition that the government's unlikely to let people slip into abject poverty in old age.
So we rely on the government, maybe too much. Maybe that was the thinking.
There were reasons for the government to create incentives for people to save for themselves and, in this case, work within the wage system to cause people to make contributions into a personal savings account. It's also important to remember that at the time there were macroeconomic concerns about the level of saving generally in Australia, and the superannuation system was one policy response to that concern.
Brendan, does it actually force people to save? I ask this because it needn't. That is to say, if you were someone with a lot of wealth, you could just save less in another form and save what you are forced to in super. Does it increase savings?
Yeah, Peter, it does tend to on average. So people do offset some of the fact that they're forced to now save 12% of their wages via super. by reducing their savings outside to a degree. But on average, I think the number is about 70 cents of every dollar of compulsory super is actually an increase in saving rather than just offsetting some other savings vehicle.
So 30 cents in the dollar gets not saved, but most of it gets saved. Who does the saving? Not only who, but at what time of life? Who is most, I suppose, forced to save, hardest hit?
Well, the short answer is it's the poor and the young, because poorer people tend to save less and people who are younger tend to save a lot less as well. Although I would probably, if I think of young people, I'm extending it up to people who are about 40, like myself, who are in the midst of kids, mortgages. That's the point when it's probably biting the most, because you would otherwise be spending money trying to pay down the mortgage, paying for your kids' education, paying to keep food on the table. You put 12% of your wage into super at that point. You probably wouldn't naturally do that at that point, because it's when you're often under the most financial stress.
I would agree with what Brendan has said. And the underlying argument here around compelling young people who might otherwise use their money to purchase houses or provide for their families is that we need to start saving early in order to maintain our standard of living in retirement. So the superannuation system, even though originally it may have been driven by a need to deal with a wage issue, the fundamental feature of a superannuation system is that it is designed to maintain your working lifestyle during retirement. But the point about the fact that super for some people is too high and arriving at the wrong time is well made.
So it's uneven in who it affects and the time of life of who it affects, Brendan. Is it also uneven in the tax benefits?
No, that's right. It is the tax concessions which reflect the fact that super tends to be taxed at a flat rate, typically 15% on contributions and on earnings, 0% on the earnings once you hit retirement. It naturally gives a larger concession for every dollar contributed to super for higher income earners than for lower income earners. And then obviously higher income earners put much more money into the system, both compulsorily and also voluntarily, because they tend to be the ones with more disposable income left over to top up their savings. It has become to a degree a tax planning vehicle as well, because the concessions are so generous. And so it's $50 billion a year of concessions. And not a lot of that, or much of that, doesn't appear to be consistent with the purposes of super, as in for retirement saving.
Where does most of that $50 billion go, if you were to cut it into half, say?
Well, about two-thirds goes to the wealthiest 20% of Australians, which tend to be older and those with larger balances, whereas those on lower incomes, you know, get very little from the system in terms of tax concessions. In fact, someone who's got, say, $5 million in super or $3 million in super, they're getting more in the value of those concessions than what someone on a low income as a retiree is getting from the full-age pension.
Susan, would people be outraged at this if it was made more apparent? That is to say, if we taxed super the same way as other income and handed out checks to the wealthiest 20% and smaller checks to the least wealthy 20%.
It's hard to say what outrages people, Peter, and a lot of it depends on the way the examples are framed to them. So if it were framed to people as a distortion of the intentions of the superannuation system that unfairly benefits the wealthy while not compensating the poor, I guess a majority of people might respond to that with outrage. But it's very hard to tell. Sometimes people would like those inequalities to remain in systems because they see themselves as one day benefiting from them.
Not now, but one day.
Yeah, not now, but one day. So maybe we need to keep this because maybe one day I'll be the person with $5 million in super. Might be a way that one person thinks about it. But I think on the whole, people's values move towards economic fairness, and most people would react the way that we ourselves react to that, which is we'd like to see systems that are both economically efficient and socially fair.
Well, maybe doing that is what the economy stupid ought to be about. That's the name of this program with me, Peter Martin. My guests this week discussing super, Susan Thorpe and Brendan Coates. Susan, how much super do we need in retirement? It presumably isn't as great a salary as we need while working because of the costs involved in going to work.
That's right. Most people who've studied this question would agree that we need somewhere in the range of 65 to 75% of our pre-retirement income to maintain our standard of living in retirement.
Not 100%.
Not 100%. Though some people may individually prefer to see their retirement as an opportunity to travel, to enjoy leisure activities that they've been putting off for some time, and may spend a much higher proportion of their pre-retirement salary in those early years. But over time, we observe that for most people, there's a drop in the amount of spending after retirement for the reasons that you've outlined, and also because people become more able to do for themselves. So they can cook at home more, they can undertake their own home maintenance, those sorts of things adjust as well. And then as we age, our ability to consume changes in different ways. So people at older ages tend to spend less because they're less able to travel, they're less interested in expensive restaurant meals, they may not be maintaining a car, at the same time that other sorts of expenses can increase. So income might be needed to be directed towards aged care support or towards medical expenses. So there's a debate about what the time path of spending is in retirement, but I'd say the consensus lies on the idea that generally people spend less after they're retired than before they're retired, and that the demands on income, particularly in a well-insured economy like Australia, tend to decline as people age.
Brendan, some of the estimates are bigger than that. The Association of Super Funds has a standard it updates. It calls it the Comfortable Retirement Standard. In the middle of 2025, it said you needed $53,300 per year for a comfortable retirement. That'd be more than 65 to 75% of what many people earn. How's the standard, the Comfortable Retirement Standard, how's it calculated?
Well, it was originally calculated or called the Comfortably Affluent Standard when ASFA, I think it was Westpac, first did that on their behalf.
And they removed the name Affluent to rename it Comfortable.
And the lower standard was called Modest but Adequate, and that became just Modest.
They removed the Adequate.
That's right. So we had a Comfortable Standard and a Modest, and who doesn't want to be comfortable in retirement?
What do they put in it? What's in that Comfortable Standard?
Well, it's a whole bunch of things, but it includes things like being able to travel abroad. It includes, going out for restaurant meals and health insurance and lots of different things.
$48 per week on alcohol, $115 per month on haircuts, an overseas trip every 7 years. It's certainly comfortable.
So the big issue, Peter, I think with the standard is the income that it suggests that you might need at age 60 or 65 is probably not that far from the mark. The issue is that they assume that your spending needs will rise in line with wages, as in you'll need to spend 20 to 30% more when you're 85 than when you're 65. And as Susan just said, and some of our research has informed that consensus, our spending tends to fall by about 20%. We spend less because our bodies, essentially, we're not able to do the kind of recreation and travel in our 80s that we did in our 60s. And the health costs that, a lot of the consumption that we're doing in our 80s, a lot of it's covered by government.
All right. Well, how much would you need to have on the day you retire? How much super saved to achieve even that comfortable standard?
A better standard is one that's actually put out by Super Consumers Australia, which is an offshoot of Choice, which makes more realistic assumptions about what people need and how that spending changes over their retirement. They suggest that you should have $310,000 for a medium or sort of typical standard of living in retirement. So that would allow you to spend $43,000 a year. And as a couple, you'd need $421,000 in super at age 65 in order to spend $62,000 a year.
So you would need far less than the millions the political debate we've had this year is about when you retire, if Super Consumers is right, to lead a comfortable or a modest standard of retirement.
Yeah, Peter, and that Super Consumers Australia work is much more consistent with a lot of the research that shows that retirees don't need to spend as much. And it might surprise listeners to hear that retirees report being the most self-satisfied on the basis of their financial comfort of any cohort in the community. I think we overestimate on average what we're going to need in retirement beforehand, and then we're pleasantly surprised when we get there about how much it actually requires.
Less financially stressed than while retirees were working.
That's exactly right.
Susan, there's one group of people for whom that's not the case, and it's renters, right? I ask that because rent is a big expense, and if you've got a house, you don't need to pay it.
That's right. These people are in a particularly precarious position. They were noted in the Retirement Income Review as the group that were most vulnerable and least well looked after. So the question that arises here again goes back to the purpose of superannuation and the extent to which the superannuation system is responsible for people's housing outcomes or should be adjusted for whether people are outright homeowners or not.
We're talking about a superannuation system, but it's only part of a broader retirement income system. You know, the typical Australian relies less on super than they do on the age pension in retirement today. And even going forward, the age pension is the safety net for most people. And so the age pension works pretty well. Most people who own their own home, they're pretty comfortable. It's not an extravagant form of living, but if you own your own home and you've got the pension, then you're doing okay. But if you are renting and you're on the pension, then you really struggle because the supplement we give to renters, Commonwealth Rent Assistance, just covers far too little of the cost of actual renting. You know, the payment maxes out.
You at the Grattan Institute are of the view that we should increase that further. We've increased it twice in the last few budgets, Commonwealth Rent Assistance, and that's the best thing you can do. Not extra superannuation. That's the best thing you can do for the people who need help in retirement.
That's right, Peter, because if you raise super, then you're forcing everyone else to save too much in order to help those renters to save enough for retirement. And we can't really predict who's going to be a renter and a homeowner during our working life necessarily. Whereas rent assistance, it's about $5,000 a year. We think it needs to rise by another $2,750 a year for singles and about $2,000 a year for couples. And that would allow those people to afford a really basic, you know, one-bedroom home in a cheap apartment in a capital city and still afford other basic essentials in life.
Before we get on to how much needs to be put away in super, I think you're getting at something of a sleight of hand here by the Association of Super Funds. They put out a retirement standard and the impression is that you need super to provide all of that standard. When people save, I think the Retirement Incomes Review found that people save more outside of super taken together and more in housing taken together. In other words, it's the least important of the three sources of income aside from the pension in retirement.
Yeah, that's right, Peter. Only the top 30% of retirees today rely on super for more than a quarter of their income in retirement. The rest is coming from the pension, from other savings, from other sources, whether it be property or shares or trusts or whatnot. And even going forward, we expect the typical young worker today, someone who's 30, by the time they retire, over their full retirement, the pension will still be half their income. Super will be most of the rest, but it will still be a minority.
And people tend to save throughout retirement. Is that true, Susan, that an awful lot of people, perhaps even the bulk of money when it's taken together, die with more money than they had when they retired?
There have been several studies that show that people do tend to save during their retirement and spend down their accumulated savings at a much slower rate than would be possible. Even the poorest households tend to maintain the small pots of savings that they have. It's not surprising that people save during retirement within the Australian system for several reasons. One is that the large amounts of wealth that they bring to their retirement accumulate earnings at a quite healthy rate for the first few years of retirement and then they grow, which is naturally what you would expect.
They're also not taxed on the earnings, so that must help.
That would certainly help. The other part of this is that there's a great deal of uncertainty about length of life. So how long are we going to live? And most of us, understandably, want to make sure that we have resources available to maintain our lifestyle until we pass away. So this means that we basically oversave compared with what we could spend if we were sharing this risk with each other.
And that's quite rational.
It's rational but inefficient.
But also, I suppose, people want to accumulate super and other forms of saving to hand on to their children. Brendan, taking all of that together, we had 9% compulsory contributions. We've got 12. How much does it look as if we should put away? Of course, it's different for the individual, but our system requires one rate.
You know, we talked about what share of your pre-retirement earnings you should replace, 65 to 70%. Well, for the poorest 30% of Australians, they're replacing more than 100%. They get a pay rise when they retire, whereas, you know, those at the top end of the income distribution are getting roughly 65%. that means you're forcing those who are struggling most during their working life to put away more than they need, which puts them under more financial stress when they're raising kids on low incomes and paying rent, or if they're lucky enough to have a mortgage. You know, it's not clear that we should have the one rate of compulsory super for everyone.
But we do.
And people also have different preferences.
All right. Well, is it less than 12%?
I think it's pretty clear that it's less than 12, because people are saving too much on average right now. And then, as Susan's pointed out, they don't spend it once they retire.
My guest this week discussing super, retirement income specialist at the University of Sydney, Susan Thorpe, and Housing and Economic Security Program Director at the Grattan Institute, Brendan Coates. Brendan, super isn't free. As fund members, we don't see the fees because they're taken out of our accounts. But the Grattan Institute says we spend more on super fees, $35 billion per year, than we do on electricity. And some of our funds are more expensive than others. Are we getting value for money, and would it help if we shopped around?
I think if you took to Cabinet a proposal, so imagine super didn't exist and, you know, the Treasurer took a Cabinet proposal that says, we're going to create a superannuation system. It's going to be government run, but the costs that I need, it's going to cost me $35 billion a year as the budget for this system to set it up. I don't think that proposal would have passed the Cabinet table at the time. But that's where we are today. We are spending $35 billion on fees. And it reflects, I think, a contradiction at the heart of the super system, which is that we set this system up to force people to save enough for their retirement when that's decades into the future, which is why they don't do it otherwise. But then we then expect those same people to invest the time to choose the best fund and the best product for them. And, you know, I think it's probably the most neoliberal moment in Australian economic policy history was to assume that consumers were going to shop around and competition would arise as a result.
We've discussed on this program how people don't shop around for petrol. Susan, I think some of the savings when the Productivity Commission did its inquiry, they found that two people in otherwise identical circumstances, one could have $660,000 less in retirement than someone else merely by virtue of what fund they chose. Is there a way out of this lottery? Is it, I suppose, telling people, and the government is doing this now, when you put in your tax return, telling people what your return is on the fund and inviting you to compare? Is there a way out of it?
I think it's pretty clear that the way out of it is not to rely on people to make some very informed decision for themselves and calculate across a range of different funds what the implications of different fee settings are.
The neoliberal moment, as Brendan Coates
said. The neoliberal moment didn't confront behavioural economics. And just the limitations of people's time and attention and their capacity for doing these calculations.
I can't do it for electricity. Right? I can't compare between suppliers just for that.
Yeah, so we're in this situation where, as Brendan points out, we have a mandatory requirement to contribute to this system. We have private, not-for-profit and for-profit providers operating within the system that are receiving the benefits of this certain flow of funds. And we have a group of people who are making these contributions who really don't have the skill set or the interest, at least until they have much larger accumulations, in figuring out whether they're getting value for money or not. But in the end, I really think we land actually where the Cooper Review took us many years ago, which is this system should work well for people who are not skilled and who are not paying attention.
What would you do, Brendan? Perhaps you'll do what the Productivity Commission recommended, which was called best in show.
Well, the Productivity Commission recommended a few things, and the good thing is a bunch of them have actually been implemented. So the system has gotten better. The typical fee in 2010 was about 1.2% of balances. It's now less than 1%. And so that reduction in fees is the equivalent of a $7 billion a year saving for working Australians.
Okay.
And so what's been done is create a performance test. So make sure every fund meets a floor. So you've got to meet this minimum standard. What's missing is getting the typical or the high-performing fund to do as well as it could. And best in show is the way to do that. So instead of relying on individuals, making choices, we basically have funds compete to get on a top 10 list of the best super funds that could be evaluated on the basis of their returns, their governance, the quality of their advice and their customer service, which is becoming a much bigger thing as people are actually retiring and needing to call on their super funds, actually access their money. And that system, we think, could make a big difference to, you know, costs and fees and performance.
So there'd be a list, say a top 10 or a top 5, and you would be allocated to one of those funds. And every few years, the funds could compete again to be best in show.
That's right. There's basically a tender. It creates what's called wholesale competition. So the funds competing amongst themselves with experts choosing, you know, maybe Susan should be one of those on the board that chooses what are the top 10 funds. No pressure.
I'm thinking about dog shows here. I can't help it. Judges, adjudicators.
Well outside my expertise.
It's not outside your expertise, Susan, because you've actually looked at who makes decisions on super, and you think we're even talking to the wrong person at times. So the idea is the tax office communicates with us, tells us how a fund has been going. How are decisions made within households?
That's a very interesting point. So the way that the funds communicate is with each of us for privacy reasons, because of the way the system is set up. But households often operate on a system where one member of the household specialises in making financial management decisions. And this is typically a person who's decided quite early in a relationship, in a long relationship, and the one who has the resources, the time, not necessarily the expertise, but the time to do their financial management. It's very, very difficult to engage the person who's not the financial manager in a household in financial decisions. And one of the struggles that the sector has is with communicating information to the person that actually guides the decision making. So within a household, a person might be guiding their partner about which superannuation fund they should be in, but the superannuation fund is trying to engage the person who's actually not that interested in the discussion.
Is it one of these cases, Brendan, where, you know, in the punchline to that joke, I wouldn't start from here? In other words, if we had designed our system the way many countries do, based on outputs, I suppose, how much you get in retirement rather than inputs, how much you put in, we wouldn't be trying to work out how to make it work better.
I think that's right. We should be grateful that we have a system at all, because we could have otherwise ended up being like the US circa 2010 with Obama trying to create a government-run private health insurance system. You know, that was the equivalent world we could have ended up in if we hadn't have made the most of that clutch.
Well, we do have the age pension, of course.
But it wouldn't have been enough, for, I think, for the typical Australian.
Well, I reckon we could afford a much bigger age pension with that $50 billion of super tax concessions.
You certainly could, and there are people that propose that from time to time, but trying to unwind those tax concessions and then work out how much pension you would receive as a result if we had a universal pension is a nightmare. It's just not really something I think that's on the table anymore.
Before we go, any quick final thoughts from each of you? Susan?
I think it's worth remembering that, as Brendan's just pointed out, we actually have a reasonably successful and strong retirement income system in Australia. It regularly rates quite highly in comparisons against other retirement income systems around the world. So for all its faults, and there are many, and for all its complications, there's a lot to be said in favour of Australia's superannuation system.
Brendan.
Look, I think the biggest challenge now is getting people to spend in retirement. You know, by 2060, the Federal Treasury expects that one in every $3 coming out of the super system that's being withdrawn will be the form of a bequest going to the kids, which is turning it into a taxpayer subsidised inheritance scheme. The big difference between our system and systems that do tend to help people spend more in retirement is that those other systems basically guarantee someone an income each year for the rest of their lives, rather than saying, here's a pot of money, work out how much to draw each year when you don't know how long you're going to live.
Thank you, Brendan Coates. Thank you, Susan Thorpe. Brendan Coates, Housing and Economic Security Program Director at the Grattan Institute. Susan Thorpe, Retirement Income Specialist and Researcher of Human Behaviour at the University of Sydney. Thanks both.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or live on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, particularly about super, you can email us, theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.